Timescape, Cassette 3.
The ambulance had departed. The WHIM staff were busy mopping up. Most of the patrons were gone, driven off by the stench. Peterson came back from the ambulance, where he'd followed, making sure the attendants had a sample of her food.
"What did they say it was?"
Markham asked. "No idea. I gave them the sausage she'd been eating. The medic said something about food poisoning, but those weren't any poisoning symptoms I've ever heard about. All we've been hearing about, impurities..."
"Maybe."
Peterson dismissed the idea with a wave of his hand.
"Could be anything these days."
Markham sipped meditatively on his stout. A waiter approached, bearing their food.
"Tongue for you, sir," he said to Peterson, placing a platter. "And sausage here."
Both men stared at their meals.
"I think..." Markham began slowly. "I agree," Peterson followed up briskly. "I believe we'll be skipping these. Could you fetch me a salad?"
The waiter looked dubiously at the plates.
"You ordered this?"
"So we did."
"Surely you don't expect us to choke it down after what's just happened to you, in a restaurant like this?"
"Well, I don't know. The manager, he says, tell your manager to watch his raw materials or I'll bloody well have this place closed down. Follow me?"
"Christ, no reason to..."
"Just tell him that, and bring my friend here another stout." When the waiter had backed away, obviously unwilling to confront either Peterson or the manager, Markham murmured,
"Great. How'd you know I'd prefer another stout?"
"Intuition," he said with weary camaraderie.
They had both had more drinks when Peterson said,
"Look, it's Sir Martin who's really the technical type on the British delegation. I'm a non-specialist, as they call it. What I want to know is, how in hell do you get around this grandfather paradox bit? And that fellow Davis explained about the discovery of tachyons right enough, and I accept that they can travel into our past, but I still can't see how one can logically change the past."
Markham sighed.
"Until tachyons were discovered, everybody thought communication with the past was impossible. The incredible thing is that the physics of time communication had been worked out earlier, almost by accident, as far back as the 1940s. Two physicists named John Wheeler and Richard Feynman worked out the correct description of light itself and showed that there were two waves launched whenever you tried to make a radio wave, say."
"Two?"
"Right. One of them we receive on our radio sets, the other travels backward in time, the advanced wave, as Wheeler and Feynman called it."
"But we don't receive any message before it's sent."
Markham nodded.
"True, but the advanced wave is there, in the mathematics. There's no way around it. The equations of physics are all time symmetric. That's one of the riddles of modern physics. How is it that we perceive time passing, and yet all the equations of physics say that time can run either way, forward or backward?"
"The equations are wrong, then?"
"No, they're not. They can predict anything we can measure, but only as long as we use the retarded wave, as Wheeler and Feynman called it. That's the one you hear through your radio set."
"Well, look, surely there's a way to change the equation round until you get only the retarded part."
"No, there isn't. If you do that to the equations, there's no way to keep the retarded wave the same. You must have the advance wave."
"All right, well, where are those backward-in-time radio shows? How come I can't tune into the news from the next century?"
Wheeler and Feynman showed that it can't get here.
"Can't get into this year, I mean, into our present time."
"Right. See, the advance wave can interact with the whole universe. It's moving back into our past, so it eventually hits all the matter that's ever born. Thing is, the advance wave strikes all that matter before the signal was sent."
"Yes, surely."
Peterson reflected on the fact that he was now, for the sake of argument, accepting the advanced wave he would have rejected only a few moments before.
"So the wave hits all that matter, and the electrons inside it jiggle around in anticipation of what the radio station will send."
"A fact preceding a cause?"
"Exactly. Seems contrary to experience, doesn't it?"
"Well, definitely.
But the vibration of those electrons and the whole rest of the universe has to be taken into account. They, in turn, send out both advanced and retarded waves. It's like dropping two rocks into a pond.
They both send out waves, but the two waves just don't add up in a simple way. They don't? Well, why not? Well, they interfere with each other. They make a crisscross network of local peaks and troughs. Where the peaks and troughs from the separate patterns coincide, they reinforce each other. But where the peaks on the first stone meet the troughs of the second, they cancel. The water doesn't move.
Ah.
All right, then. What Wheeler and Fenneman showed was that the rest of the universe, when it's hit by an advance wave, acts like a whole lot of rocks dropped into that pond. The advance wave goes back in time, makes all those other waves. They interfere with each other, and the result is zero. Nothing.
Ah. In the end, the advanced wave cancels itself out.
Suddenly, music blared over the Wim stereo.
And the devil he do the dance wump wump with Joan of Arc.
Peterson shouted, turn that down, will you?
The music faded. He leaned forward. Very well. You've shown me why the advanced wave doesn't work. Time communication is impossible.
Markham grinned.
Every theory has a hidden assumption. The trouble with the Wheeler and Fenneman model was that all those jiggling electrons in the universe in the past might not send back just the right waves. For radio signals, they do. For tachyons, they don't. Wheeler and Fenneman didn't know about tachyons. They weren't even thought of until the middle of '60s. Tachyons aren't absorbed the right way. They don't interact with matter the way radio waves do.
Why not?
Well, they're different kinds of particles. Some guys named Feinberg and Sudarshan imagined tachyons decades ago, but nobody could find them. Seemed too unlikely. They have imaginary mass, for one thing.
Imaginary mass?
Yes, but don't take it too seriously.
Seems a serious difficulty.
Not really. The mass of these particles isn't what we call an observable. That means we can't bring a tachyon to rest, since it must always travel faster than light. So if we can't bring it to a stop in our lab, we can't measure its mass at rest. The only definition of mass is what you can put on the scales and weigh, which you can't do if it's moving. But tachyons, all you can measure is momentum. That is, impact.
You have a complaint about the food, sir. I'm the manager.
Peterson looked up to find a tall man in a conservative gray suit standing over their table, hands clasped behind him, military style.
Yes, I did. Mostly I preferred not to eat it, in view of what it did to that lady a short while ago.
I don't know what the lady was eating, sir, but I should think you...
Well, I do, you see. It was certainly close enough to what my friend here ordered to make him uncomfortable.
The manager bridled slightly at Peterson's manner. He was sweating slightly and had a harried look.
I fail to see why a similar type of food...
I can see it quite plainly. A pity you can't.
Well, I'm afraid we shall have to charge you for...
Have you read the recent Home Office directives on imported meats? I had a hand in writing them.
Peterson gave the manager the full benefit of his assessing gaze.
I would say you probably get much of your imported meat from a local supplier, correct?
Well, of course, but then you presumably know that there's a severe restriction on how long it can be kept before use.
Yes, sir, I'm sure,
the manager began, but then hesitated when he saw the look on Peterson's face.
Well, actually, I haven't read much of those lately, because I think I would take more care in future. I'm not sure the lady actually ate any imported meat, whatever. I would look into it, if I were you.
Abruptly, the man lost some of his military bearing. Peterson looked at him with assurance.
Well, I think we can forget the misunderstanding, sir, in light of...
Indeed.
Peterson nodded, dismissing him. He turned back to Markham.
You still haven't got round the grandfather thing. If tachyons can carry a message back to the past... How do you avoid paradoxes?
Peterson didn't mention that he had gone through a discussion with Paul Davies at King's about this, but understood none of it. He was by no means assured that the ideas made any sense. Markham grimaced.
It's not easy to explain. The key was suspected decades ago, but nobody worked it out into a concrete physical theory. There's even a sentence in the original Wheeler-Fenneman paper... It only required that the description should be logically self-consistent. By that, they meant that our sense of the flow of time, always going in one direction, is bias.
The equations of physics don't share our prejudice. They're time-symmetric. The only standard we can impose on an experiment is whether it's logically consistent. But it's certainly illogical that you can be alive even after you've knocked off your own grandfather. Killed him before he produced your father, I mean. The problem is, we're used to thinking of these things as though there was some sort of switch involved that only had two settings. I mean that your grandfather is either dead or he isn't.
Well, that's certainly true.
Malcolm shook his head. Not really. What if he's wounded, but recovers? Then, if he gets out of the hospital in time, he can meet your grandmother. It depends on your aim.
I don't see. Think about sending messages instead of shotgunning grandfathers.
Everyone assumes the receiver, back there in the past, can be attached to a switch, say. If a signal from the future comes in, the switch is programmed to turn off the transmitter before the signal was sent. There's the paradox.
Right.
Pearson leaned forward, finding himself engrossed despite his doubts. There was something he liked about the way scientists had of setting up problems as neat little thought experiments, making a clean and sure world. Social issues were always messier and less satisfying. Perhaps that was why they were seldom solved. Trouble is, there's no switch that has two settings, on and off, with nothing in between.
Well, come now, what about the toggle I flipped to turn on the lights?
Okay, so you flip it. There's a time when that switch is hanging in between, neither off nor on.
I can make that a very short time.
Sure, but you can't reduce it to zero. And also there's a certain impulse you have to give that switch to make it jump from off to on. In fact, it's possible to hit the switch just hard enough to make it go halfway. Try it. Well, that must have happened to you sometime. The switch sticks, balanced halfway between.
All right, granted, Peterson said impatiently. But what's the connection to tachyons? I mean, what's new about all this?
What's new is thinking of these events, sending and receiving as related in a chain, a loop. Well, say we send back an instruction saying, turn off the transmitter. Think of the switch moving over to off. This event is like a wave moving from the past to the future. The transmitter is changing from on to off. Now that, let's call it a wave of information, moves forward in time, so the original signal doesn't get sent.
Right. Paradox.
Malcolm smiled and held up a finger. He was enjoying this. But wait. Think of all these times being in a kind of loop. Cause and effect means nothing in this loop. There are only events. Now, as the switch moves towards off, information propagates forward into the future. Think of it as the transmitter getting weaker and weaker as that switch nears the off position. Then the tachyon beam that transmitter is sending out gets weaker.
Ah! Peterson suddenly saw it. So the receiver in turn gets a weaker signal from the future. The switch isn't hit so hard because the backward in time signal is weaker, so it doesn't move so quickly towards the off mark.
That's it. The closer it gets to off, the slower it goes. There's an information wave traveling forward into the future, and, like a reflection, the tachyon beam comes back into the past.
What does the experiment do, then?
Well, say the switch gets near off, and then the tachyon beam gets weak. The switch doesn't make it all the way to off, and, like that toggle controlling the lights, it starts to fall back towards on. But the nearer it gets to on, the stronger the transmitter gets in the future.
So the tachyon beam gets stronger,
Peterson finished for him.
That in turn drives the switch away from on and back towards off. The switch is hung up in the middle.
Markham leaned back and drained his stout. His tan, weakened by the dim Cambridge winter, crinkled with the lines of his wry smile. It flutters around there in the middle.
No paradox.
Well, Markham shrugged imperceptibly. No logical contradictions, yes. But we still don't actually know what that intermediate, hung-up state means. It does avoid the paradoxes, though. There's a lot of quantum mechanical formalism you can apply to it, but I'm not sure what a genuine experiment will give.
Why not?
Markham shrugged again. No experiments. Renfrew hasn't had the time to do them. Or the money. Peterson ignored the implied criticism. Or was that his imagination? It was obvious that work in these fields had been cut back for years now. Markham was simply stating a fact. He had to remember that a scientist might be more prone simply to state things as they were, without calculating a statement's impact. To change the subject, Peterson asked, "Won't that stuck-in-the-middle effect prevent your sending information back to 1963? "Look, the point here is that our distinctions between cause and effect are an illusion. This little experiment we've been discussing is a casual loop, no beginning, no end. That's what Wheeler and Fenneman meant by requiring only that our description be logically consistent. Logic rules in physics, not the myth of cause and effect. Imposing an order to events is our point of view, a quaintly human view, I suppose. The laws of physics don't care. That's the new concept of time we have now, as a set of completely interrelated events, linked self-consistently. We think we're moving along in time, but that's just a bias. But we know things happen now, not in the past or future. When is now? Saying that now is this instant is going round in circles. Every instant is now when it happens. The point is, how do you measure the rate of moving from one instant to the next? And the answer is you can't. What's the rate of the passage of time? Well, it's... Peterson stopped, thinking. How can time move? The rate is 1 second of movement per second. There's no conceivable coordinate system in physics from which we can measure time passing, so there isn't any. Time is frozen as far as the universe is concerned. Then... Peterson raised a finger to cover his confusion, frowning. The manager appeared as though out of nowhere.
Yes, sir? The man said with extreme politeness.
Another round.
Yes, sir.
He hustled off to fill the order himself. Peterson took a small pleasure in this little play. To get such a response with a minimum display of power was an old game with him, but still satisfying.
But you still believe, Peterson said, turning back to Markham, that Renfrew's experiment makes sense. All this talk of loops and not being able to close switches.
Sure it'll work.
Markham accepted a glass dark with a thick stout. The manager placed Peterson's ale carefully before him and began,
Sir, I want to apologize.
Peterson waved him into silence, impatient to hear Markham.
Perfectly all right, he said quickly.
Markham eyed the manager's retreating back.
Very effective. Do they teach that in the best schools?
Peterson smiled.
Of course. There's lecture, then field trips to representative restaurants. You have to get the wrist action just right.
Markham saluted with a stout. After this silent toast, he said,
Oh yes, Renfrew. What Wheeler and Fenneman didn't notice was that if you send a message back which has nothing to do with shutting off the transmitter, there's no problem. Say I want to place a bet on a horse race. I've resolved that I'll send the results of the race back in time to a friend. I do. In the past, my friend places a bet and makes money. Well, that doesn't change the outcome of the race. Afterward, my friend gives me some of the winnings. His handing over the money won't stop me from sending the information. In fact, I can easily arrange it so I only get the money after I've sent the message.
No paradox.
Right. So you can change the past, but only if you don't try to make a paradox. If you try, the experiment hangs up in that stuck-in-between state.
Peterson frowned.
But what's it like? I mean, what does the world seem like if you can change it round?
Markham said lightly,
Nobody knows. Nobody's ever tried it before.
There were no tachyon transmitters until now.
And no reason to try to reach the past either.
Well, let me get this straight. How's Renfrew going to avoid creating a paradox? If he gives them a lot of information, they'll solve the problem, and there'll be no reason for him to send the message.
Well, that's the trick. Avoid the paradox, or you'll get a stuck switch. So Renfrew will send a piece of the vital information, enough to get research started, but not enough to solve the problem utterly.
But what'll it be like for us? The world will change around us?
Markham chewed at his lower lip.
I think so. We'll be in a different state.
The problem will be reduced. The ocean's not so badly off. But what is this state? I mean, us sitting here, we know the oceans are in trouble.
Do we?
How do we know this isn't the result of the experiment we're about to do? That is, if Renfrew hadn't existed and thought of this idea, maybe we'd be worse off. The problem with casual loops is that our notion of time doesn't accept them. But think of that stuck switch again.
Peterson shook his head as though to clear it.
It's hard to think about.
Like tying time in knots, Markham conceded. What I've given you is an interpretation of the mathematics. We know Tarkians are real. What we don't know is what they imply.
Peterson looked round at the whim, now mostly deserted.
Strange to think of this as being an outcome of what we haven't done yet. All looped together like a hooked rock.
He blinked, thinking of the past when he had eaten here.
That coal stove, how long have they had that?
Years, I suppose. Seems like some sort of trademark. Keeps the place warm in winter, and it's cheaper than gas or electricity. Besides, they can cook at any time of day, not just the power hours. And it gives the customers something to watch while they're waiting for their orders.
Yes, coal's the long-term fuel for old England, Peterson murmured, apparently more to himself than Markham. Bulky there.
When were you a student here?
In the 70s. I haven't been back very often.
Have things changed much?
Peterson smiled reminiscently.
I dare say my rooms haven't changed much. Picturesque view of the river, and all my clothes get mouldy from the damp.
He shook off his mood.
I'll have to be getting back to London soon.
They elbowed through the students to the door and out into the street. The June sunshine was dazzling after the pub's dark interior. They stood for a moment, blinking on the narrow sidewalk. Pedestrians stepped off into the street to walk past them, and cyclists swerved round the pedestrians with a trilling of bells. They turned left and strolled back towards King's Parade. On the corner opposite the church, they paused to look in the windows of Bowes and Bowes' bookstore.
Do you mind if I go in for a minute? Peterson asked. There's something I want to look for.
Sure, I'll come in too. I'm a bookstore freak. Never pass one by.
Bowes and Bowes was almost as crowded as the Wim had been earlier, but the voices here were subdued. They edged cautiously between the knots of students in black gowns and pyramids of books on display. Peterson pointed out one on a less conspicuous table towards the back of the store.
Have you seen this?
He asked, picking up a copy and handing it to Markham.
Aldrin's book? No, I haven't read it yet, though I talked to him about it. Is it good?
Markham looked at the title stamped in red on a black cover. The Geography of Calamity, Geopolitics of Human Dieback, by John Holdren. In the bottom right corner was a small reproduction of a medieval engraving of a grinning skeleton with a scythe. He thumbed through it, paused, began to read.
Look at this,
he said, holding the book out to Peterson. Peterson ran his eyes over the chart and nodded. Attributable deaths, estimated. 1984 to 96, Java, 8,750,000. 1986, Malawi, 2,300,000. 1987, Philippines, 1,600,000. 1987 to present day, Congo, 3,700,000. 1989 to present day, India, 68 million. 1990 to present day, Colombia, Ecuador, Honduras, 1,600,000. 1991 to present day, Dominican Republic, 750,000. 1991 to present day, Egypt, Pakistan, 3,800,000. 1993 to present day, General Southeast Asia, 113,500,000.
Markham whistled softly.
Is it accurate?
Oh, yes. Underestimated, if anything.
Peterson moved towards the back of the store. A girl was perched on a high stool, adding a column of figures into an auto accountant. Her fair hair hung forward, hiding her face. Peterson studied her covertly while leafing through some of the books in front of him. Nice legs. Fashionably dressed in some frilly peasant style he disliked. A blue Liberty scarf artfully arranged at her neck. Slim now, but not for many more years, probably. She looked about 19. As though aware of his gaze, she looked up straight at him. He continued to stare at her. Yes, 19 and very pretty, and very aware of it, too. She slid from her stool, and clutching papers defensively to her chest, came over to him. May I help you?
I don't know, he said with a slight smile. Maybe. I'll let you know if you can.
She took this as a flirtatious overture and responded with a routine which probably, he reflected, was a knockout with the local boys. She turned away from him and looked back over her shoulder, saying huskily,
Let me know then.
She gave him a long look from under her lashes, then grinned cheekily and flaunted her way towards the front of the store. He was amused. At first, he had really thought that she intended her coquettish routine seriously, which would have been ludicrous if she hadn't been so pretty. Her grin showed that she was play-acting. Peterson felt suddenly in very good spirits, and almost immediately noticed the book he had been looking for. He picked it up and went to look for Markham. The girl was with two others, her back to him. Her companions were laughing and staring. They obviously told her he was watching them, because she turned to look at him. She really was exceptionally pretty. He made a sudden decision. Markham was browsing through the science fiction selection.
I have a couple of errands, Peterson said. Why don't you go on ahead and tell Renfrew I'll be there in half an hour?
Okay, fine, Markham said.
Peterson watched him as he strode out the door, moving athletically, and disappeared into the alley behind the building, known as Schools. Peterson looked for the girl again. She was serving someone else, a student. He watched as she went through another routine, leaning forward more than was necessary to write a receipt, quite enough to enable the student to look down the front of her blouse. Then she straightened up and looked quite offhand as she gave him his book in a white paper bag. The student went out with a disconcerted look on his face. Peterson caught her eye and lifted the book in his hand. She slammed the cash register shut and came over to him.
Yes? She asked. Have you made up your mind? I think so. I'll take this book. And maybe you could help me with something else. You live in Cambridge, do you? Yes. You don't? No, I'm from London. I'm on the council.
He despised himself immediately, like shooting a rabbit with a cannon. No artistry at all. Anyway, he had all her attention now, so he might as well take advantage of it.
I wondered if you could recommend any good restaurants around here to me. Well, there's the Blue Boar, and there's a French one in Grantchester that's supposed to be good, Le Marquis, and a new Italian one, Il Pavone.
Have you eaten at any of them?
Well, no.
She blushed slightly, and he knew she regretted appearing at a disadvantage. He was well aware that she'd named the three most expensive restaurants. His own favourite had not been mentioned. It was less showy and less expensive, but the food was excellent.
If you could choose, which one would you go to? Oh, Le Marquis. It looks a lovely place. The next time I'm up from London, if you're not doing anything, I would count it as a great favour if you would have dinner with me there.
He smiled intimately at her.
Gets pretty dull, travelling alone, eating alone. Really? She gasped. I mean...
She struggled furiously to repress her triumphant excitement.
Yes, I'd like that very much. Fine. If I could have your telephone number.
She hesitated, and Peterson guessed she had no telephone.
Or if you'd rather, I can simply stop by this shop early on. Oh, yes, that would be best, she said, seizing on this graceful out. I'll look forward to it.
They walked forward to the front desk, where he paid for his book. When he left Bows and Bows, he turned the corner towards Market Square.
Through the side windows of the bookstore, he could see her in consultation with her two friends.
Oh, that was easy, he thought. Good God, I don't even know her name.
He crossed the square and walked through Petit Curie, with its bustling throng of shoppers, coming out opposite Christ's. Through its open gate, the green lawn and its quad was visible, and behind that, the vivid colours of a herbaceous border against the grey wall of the master's lodge. In the gateway, the porter sat reading a paper. A knot of students stood studying some lists on the bulletin board. Peterson kept on going and turned into Hobson's Alley. He finally found the place he was looking for. Foster and Jag. Coal merchants. Chapter 10. John Renfrew spent Saturday morning putting up new shelving on the long wall in their kitchen. Marjorie had been after him for months to do it. Her bland asides about where the planes of wood should go when you get around to it had slowly accreted into a pressing weight, an agreed duty, unavoidable. The markets were open only a few days each week. To avoid fluctuations in supply, was the common explanation rendered on the nightly news. And with the power cuts, refrigerating was impossible. Marjorie had turned to putting up vegetables and was massing a throng of thick-lipped jars. They waited in cardboard boxes for the promised shelving. Renfrew assembled his tools systematically with as much care as he took in the laboratory. Their house was old and lean slightly, as though blown by an unfelt wind. Renfrew found that his plumb line, nailed to the wainscoting, weaved a full 3 inches out from the scuffed moulding. The floor sagged with an easy fatigue, like a well-used mattress. He stepped back from the tilting walls, squinted, and saw that the lines of his home were askew. He put down the money on a place, he reflected, and you get a maze of jambs and beams and cornices, all pushed slightly out of true by history. A bit of settling in that corner, a diagonal misaimed there. He had a sudden memory of when he had been a boy looking up from a stone floor at his father, who squinted at the plaster ceiling as if to judge whether the roof would fall. As he studied the problem, his own children caromed through the house. Their feet thumped on the margins of polished wood that framed the thin rugs. They reached the front door and ricocheted outside in a game of tag. He realized that to them he probably had that same earnest, wrenched look of his father, face skewed in concentration. He arrayed his tools and began to work. The piles of lumber on the back porch gradually dwindled as he cut them into a suitable lattice. To fit the thin planks at the roof, he had to make oblique cuts with a ripsaw. The wood splintered under his lunging thrusts, but kept a line. Johnny appeared, tired of tag with his older sister. Renfrew sent him to work, fetching tools as they were needed. Through the window, a tinny radio announced that Argentina had joined the nuclear club.
"What's a nuclear club, Daddy?"
Johnny asked, eyes big.
"People who can drop bombs."
Johnny fingered a wood file, frowning at the fine lines that rubbed his thumb.
"Can I join?"
Renfrew paused, licked his lips, peered into a sky of carbon blue.
"Only fools get to join," he said, and set back to work.
The radio detailed a Brazilian rejection of preferential trade agreements which would have established a greater American zone with the U.S. There were reports that the Americans had tied the favor of cheaper imports to their aid on the Southern Atlantic bloom problem.
"A bloom, Daddy? How can the ocean do like a flower?"
Renfrew said gruffly.
"A different kind of bloom."
He hoisted boards under his arm and took them inside. He was sanding down the ripped edges when Marjorie came in from the garden for inspection. She had mercifully taken the battery-operated radio into the garden with her. "Why is it jut out at the base?" she asked by way of greeting. She put the radio on the kitchen table. It seemed to go with her everywhere these days, Renfrew noted, as though she couldn't bear to be alone with a bit of quiet. "The shelves are straight, it's the walls that are tilted."
"They look odd. Are you sure?"
"Have a go."
He handed her his carpenter's level. She put it, gingerly, on a rough-cut board. The bubble bobbed precisely into the place between the two defining lines.
See? Dead level.
Well, I suppose, Marjorie reluctantly conceded. Worry not, your jars aren't going to topple off. He put several jars on a shelf. This ritual act completed the job. The boxy frame stood out, functional pine against aged oak panelling. Johnny stroked the sheets of wood tentatively, as though awed that he had a hand in making this wood lattice.
Think I'll be off to the lab for a bit, Renfrew said, collecting his ripsaw and chisels.
Steady on. There's more fathering needs doing. You're to take Johnny on the mercury hunt.
Oh, hell, I forgot. Look, I thought you'd put in an afternoon tinkering.
Marjorie finished for him with mild reproof.
Afraid not. Well, look, I'll just go round to pick up some notes, then, on Markham's work. Best make it on the way with Johnny.
Can't you leave after a weekend, though? I thought you had settled things yesterday.
We worked out a message with Peterson. Ocean stuff, for the most part. We're letting pass the lot on mass fermentation of sugar cane for fuel.
What's wrong with that? Burning alcohol is cleaner than that wretched petrol they're selling now. Renfrew scrubbed his hands in the wash basin.
True enough. The snag is that the Brazilians cut back so much of their jungle for the sugarcane fields. That lowers the number of plants which can absorb carbon dioxide from the air. Trace that effect around a bit and it explains the shifts in the world's climate. Greenhouse effect and rainfall and so on.
The council decided that?
No. Research teams worldwide did. The council simply made policy to offset problems. The UN mandate, extraordinary powers and all that.
Your Mr. Peterson must be a very influential man.
Renfrew shrugged. He says it's pure luck the United Kingdom has a strong voice. The only reason we do is that we've still got research teams working on highly visible problems. Otherwise, we'd have a seat appropriate to Nigeria or the Viet Union or some other swacking nobody.
What you're doing is, what did you say, visible, isn't it?
Renfrew chuckled. No, it's bloody transparent. Peterson's deflected some help my way, but he's doing it as a sort of personal lark, I'll wager.
Well, that's very nice of him.
Nice? Renfrew dried his hands, meditating. He's interested intellectually, I can tell that, though he's no sort of intellectual in my book. It's a fair trade, I'd say. He's getting some amusement from it, and I'm getting his pound notes.
But he must think you will succeed.
Must he? Maybe. I'm not sure I do myself.
Marjorie seemed shocked. Then why do it?
It's good physics. I don't know if we can alter the past. No one does. Physics is in chaos about this thing. If there weren't a virtually complete shutdown of research, chaps would be swarming over the problem. I've got a chance here to do the definitive experiments. That's the reason. Science, love.
Marjorie frowned at this, but said nothing. Renfrew surveyed his handiwork. She began busily ranking jars on the shelves. Each had a rubber collar and metal sealing clamps. Inside swam vague blobs of vegetables. Renfrew found the sight distinctly unappetizing. Marjorie abruptly turned from her work, her face knitted with concern, and said,
You're deceiving him, aren't you?
Oh, love. What's the phrase? Keeping his expectations high. I'm not responsible for guessing his true motivations. Christ, you'll have him on the couch babbling about his early childhood next.
I've never met the man, she said stiffly.
Right. You see, this conversation has no basis. It's you we're probably talking about. You... Hold on. The thing you don't realise, Marge, old lass, is that nobody really knows anything about these experiments. You can't accuse me of false adverts yet. And for that matter, Peterson seemed as concerned as I was with the interference we're getting, so maybe I misread him.
Someone's interfering?
No. Something is. A lot of incoming noise. I'll filter it out, though. I plan to work on that very point this afternoon.
Marjorie said firmly, The mercury hunt. She clicked on the radio, which blared to a jingle.
Your honey is money in the new job-sharing plan. That's right, a couple splitting one job can help the current.
Renfrew switched it off. Be good to get out of the house, he said pointedly.
He pedaled up to the cab with Johnny. They passed farm buildings taken over by squatters, and Renfrew grimaced to himself. He'd gone round to several, trying to find the couple who'd frightened Marjorie. They'd given him a surly look and a rude, "Are we ya?" The constable was no help either. As he passed the slumped walls of a barn, Renfrew smelled the sour tang of coal smoke. Someone inside was burning the outlawed low-quality grade, but there was no bluish plume for the constable to trace. That was fairly typical. They'd spend good money on a device to suppress the visible emission, then quickly make up the cost in cheap fuel. Renfrew had heard otherwise respectable people bragging about doing precisely that, like children getting away with some delicious vice their parents had forbidden. They were the sort who threw their bottles and tins into great ruddy heaps down the woods, too, rather than trouble to recycle. He sometimes thought that the only people who obeyed the regs were the dwindling middle classes.
This ends side one of cassette 3. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.